Welcome to Radio Free Brighton and to the Middle East conversation. Hashem, who grew up in Egypt, who's also a Brighton resident, is with us in the studio. Nice to have you with us, Hashem.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be joined in a few minutes by Azzeldin El-Sharif, who is Libyan and is going to talk to us about the situation in Libya right now. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to get him on the line for the last few minutes, so the interview is a bit delayed. But Hashem, talk to us about Egypt today, Egypt since the revolution. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, since the president been removed of the control, basically everybody now, their wishes to be come true is it's in the way over. And the people there, very ambitious, and they basically fighting for their right in controlling what they're saying, and the people have a better life in different ways of working and social. And the last thing they want, I think, they start asking about the TV and the media to be changed, because the media in Egypt, it's always been very tidy for the government, and they do what the government tell them to do. So now it's all coming in a different ways of a freedom, really, and this is what they want. Most of the people want the freedom to talk about everything they want, and myself, I think it's going to be very good and very successful, a new way of democracy. And I think that most of the people would be happy with what they're gonna have. Plus, I think they're gonna put the pressure in what the police doing in Egypt, and they're gonna control that for a while, because what's happening with the police in Egypt is really completely out of order. The police there, instead of used to protect the people, they start attacking them and take money from them and all these sort of stuff. So now hopefully all of that would be changing, and different opinions gonna be raised up, especially for that reason. And I think as well, what's happening in Egypt is it's completely affecting all the Middle East, and plus that most of the issues in the Middle East that's been ignored is what's happened in Palestine and Gaza, and what the nearest to it, and all of that. Most of the people don't know much about it, because the media don't talk about it that much. But now I think what's happening in Egypt and in Libya and in Syria and Iran and all of that directions of countries, they will change a lot of things. And hopefully we did change the beast sort of frozen way, and hopefully it will come up for a peaceful way of talking to everybody. I think as well, most of the people in Egypt looking for a different thing, because the media really made most of the people confused. The TV talking about something different and calling other people tourists and other people not. The police there, all what they're doing is just controlling most of the income of the people, controlling the people of working, controlling jobs, and controlling all of that. So most of the positive things start happen, and hopefully would be a different way of living, different way of being Egyptian and being Middle Eastern. Back to you, Jim.
Thank you, Hashem. Forgive me for changing the subject so abruptly, but our speaker this morning, who is Libyan, and is going to talk about Libya, has just come available from another interview. He's a busy guy this morning. It's been a bit of a struggle to get hold of him. Azzeldin, can you tell us a bit about yourself first?
My name is Azzeldin El-Sharif. I'm the founder of the British Libyan Solidarity Campaign in the UK, and I live in Manchester. At the moment, I'm in London, because we have a demonstration later in front of the 10 Downing Street.
Yes, now it's not too late to remind our listeners, we did talk about this on our news here last night, Azzeldine, that there is a demonstration today at 12 Downing Street. Would you like to give our listeners some more details?
Because of the situation in Libya, we are demonstrating in front of the 10 Downing Street, demanding the British government to declare or announce a real condemnation. It's not just asking Gaddafi to stop, but also to put Gaddafi's regime under sanctions and to boycott Gaddafi's regime and to jam their accounts in the UK and to ask Europe to do so.
Azzeldine, could you please give us some background to the situation in Libya, some background to the rise of Gaddafi 42 years ago?
Gaddafi actually, since he has been in power, he isolated Libya from the outsider community, and also he gave the major companies control to his family. And that is kind of control. He gained more power against the Libyan people. And 2 years ago, or earlier than that, the promises from Gaddafi and his son Seth that they are going to reform, and also they are going to give power to people. They will go for a constitution and also to distribute the wealth of Libya on people, and all that was lie after lie after lie.
Remind us please of how Gaddafi came to power in the first place, and talk to us about the British responsibilities at that time when Gaddafi first came into power.
I believe that the problem with the West, they do only look to their own interest. They don't look to other people's interest. They guarantee the relationship with leaders like Muammar Gaddafi, whatever he is, however he acts. And they look for the interest for their own. If they can have this relationship, then they ignore anything can happen. We have seen that through Saddam Hussein when he was the ally for the West. They ignored his torture to his people, the killing, the chemical weapons against his people. I mean, the Kurdish Saddam Hussein killed his own people by chemical weapons. They were blind and deaf there. But when he becomes mad against the West, they said, oh, we want to implement democracy and freedom in Iraq. And that's why we have seen America and Britain calling the international community to involve in a holy war, because George Bush said that he's been or God talked to him to go to Iraq. Tony Blair said God talked to him also to go to Iraq. And what we see now, that the people of Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and other countries in the region, they are saying their say, and they are coming out for their own freedom, and they will build their own democracy, not the one which is implemented by the British government and the American government by sending fighter jets and bombarding the civilians and kill millions, like what they did in Iraq. But the people, they are going to build their own relationship. They are going to build their freedom and democracy with their blood.
talk to us now, if you would, about what life has been like under Gaddafi. We've heard stories of prisons in Tripoli where political prisoners have been held. We've heard of disappearances. We've heard these kinds of things. Give us a picture of what life was like under Gaddafi and what level of freedom of speech or influence the Libyan people have had.
I know that when Gaddafi came to power by a military coup, and the civil society in Libya straight away said to the army, thank you very much for the change, and we want to build a civil society or civil country. And Gaddafi then refused, and he said that I brought this revolution, and I will guard it with his group. So they took power, and they stayed in power. Gaddafi wanted to stay forever. That's why he changed the country to a camp, a military camp system. Gaddafi started first by killing and assassinating his members of the coup group, or which is called the United Council of the Revolutionary Military, or what was.
Yeah.
So he started by that, and he put everybody under his word, and then he changed the country from a republic to the system, which is, I see it, is a military camp where everybody will be watched and noticed by his regime. So that's why it took us too long to see a change in Libya. The life under Gaddafi is horrific. Gaddafi, in the name of freedom, in the name of revolution, in the name of socialism, he made our life horrible. We hated being Libyans. We hated the oil, the gas, because we didn't benefit of it. The what we have seen is just corruption and assassination, detention, imprisonment, hanging in the public, very, 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 very bad oppression. And through all these 42 years, the Libyans couldn't have a dignity life. Gaddafi took our money, took our lands, burned the registrar of the land. So nobody has got any evidence of what he owns, his family, his what he has inherited from his grandparents in Libya. Gaddafi changed the life in Libya. People lost their jobs, lost their properties. Gaddafi said, whoever lives in a house, it belongs to him. And when and that means, you know, when you see it, it means, all right, this is some kind of a justice. But it wasn't justice, because Gaddafi stopped the development, building development, or housing development. Gaddafi stopped the commercial development. All these things stopped. Even the trade, he put it down. People owns shops, they become workers. Instead of owning their own shops, business, companies, factories, they become workers in those
shops and yeah. workplaces.
And one day he ordered the army to surround the gold market in Libya, in every city in Libya, and brought the owners of those shops and ordered them to open the shops and safes. Yeah, the safes.
Yes.
Opened them in front of them, and they took everything inside what they own. People, some of them burned themselves, some of them hit by strokes, some of them got mad. All what they owned, what they gathered, what they worked all their lives, they've lost it in 1 second. Gaddafi changed the money to get people in poverty in 1978-79. Gaddafi changed the currency in Libya, and he gave the right to each family to have only 1,000 dinars. 1,000 dinars only.
Which is what, in pounds?
In pounds, it used to be, at that time, actually about 3,000 pounds. But Gaddafi changed that, this kind of currency, and it became one pound makes 6 pounds at a later time, six Libyan dinars. So he created poverty in Libya by taking the money from people. Libya, we had before very little amount of people who so-called rich. We didn't have millionaires, but we used to have middle class. The majority of Libyans are middle class people working, earning their living. And also we had a very little amount of people, they are under the poverty. But we have to understand that we have to understand that Libya was under the Italian colony, and then the British ruling, and then we discovered the oil in 1962, and Libya started selling the oil in 1964, 65. So Libya was a poor country, and the development started at the King Idris's period. In 1969, when Gaddafi made the coup, everybody thought, all right, he is for the people, came out, supported him. After 4 years, Gaddafi abolished the law in Libya, and he becomes the law. And then he changed the system, and he said that public ruling country. And he said that his position will be just the leader of the revolution and the new method or theory, which is the Green Book and the third theory for the world, which is he has got the Green Book to solve the world's problems, democracy, social and economy, which you can see and you can read the Green Book. It has got some kind of good says, which is we all believe in it, but mixed with very, very bad theories or thoughts, and it's not benefiting the people of Libya. And he used that to control Libyans, to control the wealth of Libya. He said Libyan people ruling the country, but we didn't meet with any representative of Europe or any other country of the world. When presidents or prime ministers, if they go to Libya, they meet with Gaddafi, and now they meet with, or before they meet with Gaddafi's family, and Gaddafi's family is sent to represent Libya. So we have been shifted from a socialist country, a social justice cause and freedom and the public ruling country, to a family country, to a one-party country, to a one-man decision country. And he said that the wealth of Libya is in the hands of the Libyans. And we discovered that we are just having that in the slogans. In reality, we have more than the third of Libya under the poverty line, in a very, very wealthy country. And the population of Libya, when Gaddafi took power, we were about 2.3 million. And the Libyans now, they didn't reach 6 million at the latest report, that Libyans are around 6 million. 2 million are Africans. So they are not, you know, Libya means Libya didn't reach 5 million in reality. So, and if you look to Libya as a country, it is a huge country, and it has got the very, very different environment, means like green mountains all year, desert, seaside, a very beautiful country could be in the world. But unfortunately, Gaddafi ruined all that. And the third thing, which is Gaddafi said that it's controlled by people, which is the army. The Libyan people being forced, I was forced to go to the army instead of staying 6 months to give my contribution to my country, to be in the army for 6 months. I been in the army for more than 3 years. And when they discovered that I am a brother of what's so-called a stray dog in 1984, because my brother, he used to live in the UK since 1968, he came here to study, they called me a brother of stray dog, and the relationship, that because of the relationship between Britain and Libya was very bad. And I will remind you of some facts or from the history when the Libyan protesters came out, the Libyan embassy protesting, guarded by the British police in 1984.
Yes.
After Gaddafi started hanging students in universities. So Libyan students and Libyan activists in exile living in the UK came out protesting, and you can imagine that the staff from the Libyan embassy came out with machine guns and opened fire on the protesters, injured 21 person and killed Yvonne Fletcher, who was standing facing protesters, her back to the embassy, get shot, killed,
yeah,
or guarding these people. Unfortunately, not the conservative government at that time could bring those killers to justice. Not Tony Blair and his government could bring those killers to justice. And it is, this crime went to negotiation for compensation, and that's what Gaddafi used to remain in power, and that's what he succeeded in. And we see that the Western governments they are very, very likely to accept compensation if it is a big price. And they forget about whose life it is, if it is a woman or if it is civilians killed in an airplane crash, like or bombed, like Lockerbie bombing, and the Americans, British, Italians, whoever, Libyans die, it's no problem because Gaddafi can pay high price in compensation to these lives, and investment can carry on in Libya, and the BP can go to Libya and forget about Libyan people, how they live. And now we would say to the British government, to the European government, to American government, that they have to consider their behavior towards the Libyan people and towards the people living in the region, like Tunisians, Moroccans, Africans. They have to change their behavior, because the world 50 years ago, it's not the world 10 years ago, it's not the world today.
No. Talk to us now, would you please? Actually, I very much want to move on to why this revolution has happened now, why in some ways it's taken so long. But before we move to that, can I ask you about the Al-Megrahi case? Because we've recently been looking at Dispatches from the Dark Side on Torture and the Death of Justice, a book by the British human rights lawyer Gareth Pearce, where she presents an argument that the Megrahi case was very much a framing of Al-Megrahi. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Yes. The case of Al-Megrahi, I was in Libya when Gaddafi celebrated the victory. I give you background to that. Gaddafi has involved in confronting the West because he has got a lot of money and he thought that he can change the world. And that's the same with Saddam, with Arab leaders or the region leaders. Gaddafi has used the wealth to support any flame or conflict around the world. As I said, in 1984, the relationship between the West, especially Britain and Libya, was very bad.
Yeah.
In 1996, Gaddafi involved before it was in the same month, could be the same week, when Gaddafi bombed the American army or American soldiers in the nightclub in Germany. Mm-hmm. Reagan was the president of the USA at the time, and he announced the attack on Libya. And he launched the attack on Libya with the support of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person that I studied all my life, I know Gaddafi, how he thinks, and the revenge, the love of the revenge to his enemy, how much is the love, and you see it now, how he did it. Gaddafi, you know, worked in fighting the West with money, supporting rebels, supporting revolutionary groups. Even here in the UK, I've learned that Gaddafi used to support some groups here, even in their printing. He paid money to them to support them in their printing against the British government. Gaddafi involved in Lockerbie bombing. That's, I believe it 100%, not 99%. I believe it 100%. Gaddafi paid a lot of money to harm America and Britain. And because America launched the war on Libya through Britain, Gaddafi replied to that by bombing the Lockerbie, Pan Am American airplane in the UK, which was Lockerbie base. So it is two targeted in one. The humiliation that Reagan has made against Gaddafi by bombing his own house. So I want to come back to Gaddafi's revenge. He's been humiliated by bombing his own house where he lives, not just the army or security bases in Libya, but his house. So that can give you how much Gaddafi will revenge and the commitment from Gaddafi to look how or where and when to fight back.
So was Megrahi working for Gaddafi?
He was an agent for Gaddafi, but I will come to this because I just give you a background of why Gaddafi bombed or the airplane in Lockerbie. Mm-hmm. This is the relationship between us. So 1986, America bombed Gaddafi's house. He revenged by supporting the IRA, supporting other groups, and he bombed the Pan Am American airplane in Lockerbie. At that time, I was in Libya, and I've heard Gaddafi himself in a big celebration, we can do it. And we can reach them as much as they can reach us. And he celebrated a victory against America and Britain. That is Al-Megrahi. Now I'm going to come to Al-Megrahi himself. Mm-hmm. This crime is being planned by a state. It's not one man plan. It's not one man crime. But we want to come to, as I said to you, there is kind of hypocrisy, kind of interest and agreement. Gaddafi wouldn't release Al-Megrahi or give Al-Megrahi to America to be taken to justice and out of Libya. He wanted to keep him in Libya and get him released afterwards. But the pressure from the international community led to make Gaddafi give Al-Megrahi to be taken to justice in Scotland. So, number one, I would say it is a state crime. The accusation put on one person, and this is injustice. Gaddafi gave Al-Megrahi to the West, but he kept his family in Libya. Al-Megrahi couldn't say anything related to the truth because his family are hostages in Gaddafi's hands. I've heard some news now which is saying that Al-Megrahi has been killed. Gaddafi regime killed Al-Megrahi in this conflict. I'm not confirming this news, but this is what I've heard. I don't know exactly if it is true or not, but that's what I've heard from inside Libya, and we are going to see if it is true or not soon. But what I believe that Al-Magrahi could be a part, could be part of this crime, or he's being given as scapegoat. And I believe that the system, the justice system, wasn't clear and wasn't actually justified by making their decision on one person. And I believe that was because of under the table deals
between
the West and Gaddafi.
Yes,
because they gave him the guarantee that they are not going to come to his side, that just we want get somebody and make our people happy.
Yeah. So moving on now to the current situation, and may I just say at this stage that apologies to any listeners who've just joined us listening to the Jamie and Joe show, but we are continuing this very important interview because we've been kindly joined by Azzeldin El-Sharif on the Middle East Conversation Show this morning. Azzeldin El-Sharif is the chair of the British Libyan Society and is giving us a lot of extremely useful information in helping us to understand the current situation in Libya. Jamie and Joe's show will be starting, but it'll be starting about 25 past 11 today, so that we can continue this interview with Azzeldin El-Sharif. Mr. Sharif, thank you again for joining us. And could you please talk to us now about why it's taken so long for the Libyan people to start a revolution against Gaddafi?
All right. As I mentioned earlier, that Gaddafi has the control over the major companies in Libya. Now, Gaddafi controls the telecom, the big companies like the investment companies outside Libya. He gave his sons to split between them above the ground. What is above the ground is split between Gaddafi's sons and supporters. And what is under the ground is in his only hand. And that's why Gaddafi is talking about billions to bring the interest of the West and the Africans and everybody to build a relationship with him. And he has used that, you can say, perfectly. Gaddafi's sons, they control the media, they control the communication companies, and they communicate the investment, the oil companies, in which is the suppliers or the sellers. Like some companies he bought in Switzerland, in Italy, in Yunnan, in Malta, in different countries in the world. So they own these companies. By this, and add to that, other sons, which is like Khamis and Saif al-Arab and Saadi, they control the security army. The Libyan army is being crushed. Gaddafi finished the army of Libya because he he was always suspicious of a military coup. And he built a new army, which is the security army, and that's what he used now against the Libyan people.
Yes, there's not just one army at work, is there, now?
Again.
He divided the army, didn't he? Can you explain to us, because there's about four or five different Libyan armies now, aren't there?
The army, he focused on the security for the family and the government.
Yeah.
He has got the personal safety army. And then he has got the security army to face the Libyans. And they are all under Gaddafi's sons, Saadi, Saif al-Arab, and Khamis. We see Saif, another face, to build relationship with the Western people, showing them that he is a pro-democracy, he is a freedom, you can say, a negotiator, or he wants the positive or the better life for the Libyan people, and he painted himself to the West that he is their son for the next after Gaddafi. You can say, plans put Libyan people under control of Gaddafi and his family and supporters. Poverty, sickness, diseases, humiliation, every kind of negative life. No infrastructure in Libya. Everything is demolished. Everything is going backwards. So that's why Libyans couldn't have the say. That's one side. The other side is the silence. The silence of the West. The silence of America and Britain and the European countries. And the one self-interest, the selfishness of the West. And the proof of that, the example that George Bush and Tony Blair set up in Iraq by demolishing the whole country because of the madness of Saddam Hussein. And they set up him as an example for the other leaders. The other leaders learned from Saddam Hussein, if they don't obey to the West, they will be brought to their justice, like what they did to Saddam Hussein. And you know, Gaddafi learned from that perfectly. The killing of Saddam Hussein's sons put Gaddafi's sons in the examination. And they put a pressure on their father that they don't want Arabs, they don't want Africans, they don't want nuclear or chemical weapons. We want to live. We want to enjoy our life. We want to be princes. That's what they wanted. And they made it. They put a pressure on Gaddafi. So he announced the his hidden chemical weapon factory, and he announced that he is giving up his madness, and he gave to America. He didn't announce it that he gave up and he gave it to the United Nations, but he gave it to America, to George Bush. And George Bush and Tony Blair, they put that as a credit to their democracy, the kind of democracy that implemented by them in Iraq, by bombing civilians, by destroying country, and stealing the oil of Iraq, and bringing poodles, and creating conflicts between tribes and sectors. creating sectarians in Iraq. That's what happened, and the example they set up, they worked. So, and we saw all these people who are oppressing their countries, like the leaders of the Middle East and the leaders of Africa. They prey in America, or they prey on the American mat. They don't pray, or they don't worship their countries, but they worship the orders of the UK and America. And this gave the other reason for Gaddafi to stay longer in power. We cried. The Libyan opposition groups didn't sell themselves out to the West. They didn't accept what the Iraqi burglars, which is they were in opposition to Saddam Hussein, and they agreed to the Americans, to Britain, to go with them on tanks to kill Saddam Hussein, but it wasn't to kill Saddam Hussein, but to demolish the whole country. The Libyan opposition groups refused to have a suspicious relationship with the West. They refused to give a drop of blood of their people to the West, or to allow them to go on tanks to Libya. So that is another reason why Libya was under Gaddafi for a long time. We didn't have support from the West. And I have launched the British-Libyan Solidarity Campaign in 2006 in response to to Tony Blair's visit and the new relationship between Britain and Libya, and the memorandum of understanding between Libya and Gaddafi to handle any Libyan who is not wanted to the British government, who's not wanted in the UK society, to be handed to Gaddafi. So we have refused
to cooperate.
Yes, cooperation, and we campaigned with Amnesty International. We campaigned with other groups. We have launched a petition online to the 10 Downing Street, but unfortunately, nobody listened to us. Nobody listened to us, and that gave Gaddafi more power to stay longer and to torture his own people.
Yes. Mr. El Sharif, tell us what you think Gaddafi is going to do next.
Well, we have heard Gaddafi's son stating that they are going to fight the Libyan people because they called for a regime change, and they are going to use all the weapons they have, and they are going to fight the Libyan people till the last man and woman, and they are going to fight the Libyan people till the last energy that they've got, which is can give the picture, give the intention, the commitment from Gaddafi to kill his own people to revenge badly and by bloodshed in the country, killing civilians, innocent people from age of 1 year and 4 months to old people. A woman in her house got shot by a bullet, came from the Gaddafi's mercenaries. It is will be the worst part of this world and of this history and of this century. Gaddafi is method in killing his people by using fire jets, anti-warcrafts,
missiles,
weapons and missiles, and bringing mercenaries to kill his own people. It didn't happen in Tunisia. It didn't happen in Egypt. It didn't happen in anywhere in the world. If we saw Hitler killing the Jews, burning them, fighting other countries, Gaddafi is worse than Hitler. Gaddafi is killing his own people. He is a fascist. He is more than a fascist. And I want the people to think, not once, not twice this time, they should think many times why they shouldn't support the Libyan people in their struggle for freedom, for democracy, to build the tools of democracy, to build the life, the independent life, and the self-determination, and also their choice for freedom. They should be supported now by putting sanctions on Gaddafi's family and supporters, and put them, if they have got anybody out of country, they should get them, capture them, and put them in detention until they stop their action against their own people, and to bring them to justice, to jam their accounts, the money they have got, the property they own outside Libya and inside Libya, to be seized and not to be controlled by anybody until the Libyan people gain their freedom and make their decision on that or those properties. And I believe that the West, and I talk to you about the Western government.
Yes.
I have heard some condemnations, which is very, very bad, very rough, very, very soft. And the useless Italian minister who said, oh, we should call for conciliation and we shouldn't put sanctions on Gaddafi's family. I would say to him, listen, the Libyan people are dying every minute under Gaddafi, and you are talking about conciliation. Do you want to support a war criminal and bring him back to rule the country? No. We made our decision, and we are going further. We are not going back. And you know, your problem will be the whole Italian people problem. We are not going to build a relationship with Italy until they stop this support to Gaddafi. And you know, whatever we need to buy from Italy, we are going to buy it from any other country. Didn't make any comment like that. And I appreciate the comment from Alexander, the minister of Finland, who said that we should put sanctions on Gaddafi's regime, Gaddafi's family, and seize their accounts and support the Libyan people in their decision for freedom, and we should pro people, not pro Gaddafi. So I would say to all of them, Cameron, you have to decide right now. The Libyan people now under fire. And you know, America, Britain, for just a homemade missiles from Gaza sent to Tel Aviv, the whole continent, the whole world reacted to that, and we have seen the demolition of Gaza by the Israelis' hands. I would say to them that the Libyan people now, they need protection. They need protection, and they don't need your missiles to be sent to the Libyan people, but we want your political decision. We want your political decision to be made right now.
Thank you, Mr. El-Sharif. Now, I do want you to remind us of the details of the demonstration before we close the program. But
yes.
First of all, Hasham from Egypt would like to ask you some questions.
Hello, Mr. Azzedine. Ahlan wa sahlan. I would like to ask you about what the future of the businesses that in the Middle East, because as you know, most of the past or 100 years ago, all the businesses that linked completely benefit the government that's controlling the region, all of the Middle East. And as we know, it's all about oil and fuel and all of that. What the future of the Middle East into these businesses, because all of these businesses connect to Europe politicians and the Middle East politician, but it's just for benefit special pockets, which is the prime ministers, the government, and all of this, and they ignore completely the welfare right of a human being, right?
Absolutely.
Do you think in the future, is that all going to be changed? Are we going to have a better human being right? Are we going to have a dignity as everybody fighting for? Or is it going to be just as it is, a new business is coming in to take a fuel for cheap prices, and the Middle East is just being back a long time ago, since now 100 years, maybe more? Do you think is that going to be changed?
Well, for the past 6 years, we have campaigned here in the UK. We sent letters to the parliament members. We tried to speak to the government that they should put human rights before businesses. Nobody listened to us. Nobody listened to us. And now we have seen the people's movement in Tunisia and in Egypt and now in Libya and around the region, in Yemen, in Jordan, in Syria, in Sudan, all of the region will be transformed. And it is the people's revolution. It is not somebody's coup. And I would say this, we are not going to give it to anybody. We are not going to let anybody to hijack it. And I tell you this, we are going to put human rights, the tools of democracy first, for the people to decide, for the people to oppose any decision not to be implemented on them by force. And you know, the Egyptian people, they've learned, the Libyan people, they've learned the lesson as well, the Tunisians also. It is gonna be very different life. And this is the message I deliver to the West. The people before government, I would say to them that we are going to build a very respectful relationship with countries who are respecting our rights, who are going to put people before leaders, who are going to put human rights and be pro-democracy in the region before businesses. And you know, the kind of investment and development will be very, very different. The wealth of Libya and the strength of Egypt and the population of Tunisia and other countries will share the wealth. The next fight for us and for me personally will be the borders. We are going to fight the borders between the countries we live in. We are going to fight the borders in Africa, all Africa, because Libya will be more beneficial to its own people and to the people in the region. The Egyptians, the Libyans, the Tunisians, the Moroccans, the Africans should have the joy of freedom of movement, of freedom of living. And this will make a united, diverse, peaceful region, peaceful continent, and we can manage our wealth.
Definitely.
We can manage our life.
This seems to be a very good plan. Do you mind if I ask you, can we make another interview with you? My name is Hashim Nagdi from Egypt.
Yeah. So in the meantime, please don't go away, Mr. El-Sharif. But in the meantime, we'd like to say thank you for listening to this episode of Middle East Conversation. And Hashim and Azzedine El-Sharif will be back to talk to us again later in the week.